This is The Set List, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at shows Friday and Saturday, August 22nd and 23rd, near Itasca State Park, in Bemidji, Walker, and Grand Rapids. Starting things off with the Mississippi Headwaters Music Fest in Itasca Township this Friday and Saturday. Located not far from Itasca State Park, the festival's Friday lineup includes Forge North, The Bad Decisions, and more, with music beginning at 3 p.m. On Saturday, the Lydia Rose Band, Kitschy Boogie, and others are playing with music beginning at 12:30. The specific address can be found online. It's Mississippi Headwaters Music Fest this weekend. Also Friday night, Sam Miltich and the Clearwater Hot Club will be at Bridget's in Bemidji at 6 p.m. Playing the hot club jazz of Django Reinhardt alongside straight-ahead tunes and Balkan folk music. The group feature original songs alongside jazz standards and folk traditionals. Sam Miltich and the Clearwater Hot Club Friday night at Bridget's in Bemidji. On Saturday, country and folk icon Steve Earle is coming to the Northern Lights Casino in Walker. Active since the mid-70s, Earle has 7 Grammy-nominated albums, winning 3 of them, and is best known for songs like Copperhead Road, Guitar Town, Galway Girl, and many more. Most recently, he continued a series of cover albums with a tribute to Jerry Jeff Walker in 2022. The opener is country singer Calder Allen. It's Steve Earle at Northern Lights Casino in Walker this Saturday at 6. At the same time, folk rock quartet Morning Bird are playing Rapids Brewing in Grand Rapids. Led by multi-instrumentalist Jill Burks and Josh Palmy, the group is rounded out by the rhythm section of Shane Kingsland and Jim Pedala. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hello, I'm Catherine Cullen, sitting for Neil Cooksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Bargaining chip. A Canadian Labour Congress leader says it's time to throw out the Labour Code rule that the Liberals have leaned on to end strikes at the expense of workers' rights.
Seeking a stronghold on a stronghold. As part of a peace deal, Vladimir Putin wants the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, but that would mean ceding a key line of defense and making Ukraine vulnerable to another Russian invasion.
Rising through the ranks, Canadian soldiers are allegedly caught on video at a party giving Nazi salutes, raising the question of whether the military has an extremely concerning problem with extremism.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, archaeologists unearth new artifacts at the homestead of John Ware, a formerly enslaved man who became Canada's most famous cowboy.
With their own bare hands, chocolate scientists continue their life-changing work uncovering what gives the confection its flavor and unlocking the stunning possibility of chocolate that could taste even better.
And Lockjaw, a history-making discovery in oral hygiene, could see a new product on the shelves in just a few years, toothpaste made out of hair. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that hopes they've performed a thorough tress rehearsal. It's happened over and over. Faced with strikes or lockouts, the federal government has invoked Section 107 of the Labour Code to force workers back to the job and negotiators back to the table. They've done it with airline mechanics, ports, railways, Canada Post, and now flight attendants. It's a move that allows the Labour Board to issue a back-to-work order without parliamentary sign-off in order to, in the language of the code, maintain or secure industrial peace. Each time, it's forced strikers to back down. But this time, the flight attendants' defiance is prompting a rethink of the law.
We're going to stay strong. We're going to stay committed to making sure that those workers can do the job that they love doing. And if it means folks like me going to jail, then so be it. If it means our union being fined, then so be it.
That's Mark Hancock, head of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, or CUPE, speaking to reporters earlier this week after striking flight attendants decided to remain on the picket line, even after Labour Minister Patty Hajdu invoked Section 107 of the Labour Code. And that resistance seems to have paid off. Air Canada and its flight attendants reached a tentative deal yesterday, and the Canadian Labour Congress is now calling for an end to Section 107. Siobhan Vipond is the vice president of the Canadian Labour Congress. We reached her in Ottawa.
Siobhan, how much more willing do you think unions are going to be to defy back-to-work orders now?
It's always an inspiration, right, that people don't think they're alone. I think workers, absolutely, they're looking, going, oh, wait a minute, they were able to do it. Maybe we can do it. But also, this has been used so many times. I think workers are looking at it and going, I'm not accepting this. And so, yeah, that, of course, has an impact where people are going, okay, we're going to do this. We also take that energy to go, okay, we can actually make this system better and protect our constitutional rights.
You say an inspiration, but some people will look at this and say, was breaking the law. What do you say to them?
Well, what they did is defy an order. The courts have not said that they broke the law. Quite honestly, you know, that's why there's going to be a case. That's why they're going to court. It's why they felt comfortable, because we have a constitutional right in Canada to, you know, fair and collective bargaining. And that is part fair and free collective bargaining. And part of that is the right to strike. And so, yeah, it is unfortunate this is how it played out. I mean, I think we could see how this played out this way, because there was an expectation by the, you know, employer, right? So we saw Air Canada not actually going to the table ready to get a deal, because they thought 107 was going to come in and save them. Because once they did get to the table, they did get to a deal.
Section 107 has been used 8 times since last June. Why was this time different in terms of the response from the union, the decision to hold the line, as it were?
You know, we are democratic organizations, and these workers had given a very clear message to their union that this is what they wanted to do. And then they decided that they wanted to keep going. And so it's the power of those members. And if the members don't want to do something, it doesn't happen, right? You know, you heard we are coming together as a labor movement and supporting that and supporting those actions, whether it's legal, but also pushing and pressuring so that we get rid of this 107.
Well, and I would like to talk about what the Labor Minister, Patty Hajdu, has said about the decision to use Section 107. Here she is speaking to Power and Politics on Monday.
Look, this is never an easy choice, and it certainly wasn't an easy choice this time. Collective bargaining is a super important principle in this country that this government fully believes in. But there are times where it is clear that the parties are protracted, cannot agree on a collective agreement. And, you know, in fact, when both parties say that they're at an impasse, they clearly need another tool, and that's what we provided them.
She describes it as a tool that was provided to the parties. You say, get rid of it. How do we square that?
Well, we say get rid of it because it's a tool that only helps the employer, right? You had workers who were on strike, and let's not forget how quickly it was put out, right? Like, it was hours. And then suddenly it was like, nope, this strike is it's too long and it's not working. We know that, yeah, they were far, but if they have that pressure of needing to get a deal, if that is the goal, then they can make it happen.
So where do you think that leaves you, given what the minister just said, in your quest to have Section 107 removed from the Labour Code? If the federal government sees it as a tool and has used it multiple times in the past few months, how hard is it going to be to convince them that this is something that has to go?
Well, I mean, we've heard from New Democrats that they would get it. They will, you know, want to get rid of it. We've heard from other parties as well.
Which other parties?
We're in a minority situation. The Bloc have said, you know, in the past that they would do it. So we're going to be pushing and doing everything we can, which is to put on that pressure that this is not the right tool.
But I guess I'm still left with this question of whether it's possible that what I understand to be the minister's theory here, that the fact that they invoked this put pressure on both sides, because it did put pressure on the union as well, the possibility of fines and of jail time to get everybody on the same page. Is it possible that even though you don't like the tool, it led to the result we have now?
The tool's unconstitutional. I don't know if it put the pressure. The pressure of the union was there, right? Because they were on strike. And yes, they had to make some tough decisions, and they decided to to keep going with the strike, even though this was, they were trying to introduce this back to work through 107. But it was just helping the employer to go, no strike, right? They're being used to take the workers' power away. They're not being used to try and even the tables. The evening of the power at a table, because an employer implicitly has power just given that they're the ones who, you know, are the owner, or they're the ones who run these organizations. They make the decision. And the counter to that, the positive counter to be able to have discussions, social dialogue and influence, is actually unions being at a table and these rights that we have as workers, you know, through our constitution. And then you see that in the rules. So I hear the words that are being said that, you know, it was justified, but it's not justified, not justified under our constitution, not justified in the fact that it was taking away the ability for workers to strike, which is, you know, really important to this balance of power, because that's what's important when we talk about workers' rights. There is a lot of profit being made at Air Canada. There's a lot of, you know, the CEO is well compensated. And then we have workers who are not even being able to make a living wage. That is being undone by what they did. And I think all of us, it was a hard few days. It's going to be a hard time as it gets there. I know these workers didn't want that inconvenience to their passengers, but that's Air Canada's fault. That's not these workers. These workers have now set a better tone for what's happening. And so when we look at the labor law, we will be making sure that, you know, that government understands, but this was a complete overstep. And we would have gotten to a deal if government had stayed out of it, because that is the process. And in Canada, over, you know, 90% of, you know, collective agreements are settled without strikes, lockouts, or any of us even being aware that it's happening, because there's bargaining happening all the time in those situations. This one became news because, obviously, because it's big, but also because it ends up in a strike that affects so many of us.
Siobhan, thank you for this conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Siobhan Vipond is the Vice President of the Canadian Labour Congress. She's in Ottawa. Once again, the Canadian Army is dealing with soldiers accused of hateful conduct. This time, the story centers on a short video allegedly featuring troops at a house party in Quebec giving a Nazi salute. According to the Department of National Defense, 5 serving officers have been identified and suspended while the military investigates. Tony Batista is a retired Canadian Armed Forces colonel who also served in the military police. We reached him in Ottawa.
Tony, do you believe the Canadian Army has a problem with extremism and hate?
There is definitely a problem. Now, the extent of that problem is a different question. Any extremism is problematic. And so when these issues come up, the best thing to do is to deal with them as decisively as possible. Of course, with the understanding that things have to be properly investigated and that we have to get the facts right.
Okay, we'll talk a bit about where to go from here in a moment. But first, I'd like to know what went through your mind when you heard about this case of an apparent video of serving officers allegedly giving Nazi salutes.
Yeah, first, I was disappointed. There's no question. As a retired military officer, having started in the ranks and gone through all the way to the rank of colonel, I've seen some of these things in my lifetime. So I was disappointed. We're in a different society today. The Canadian forces, the Canadian Armed Forces, are a reflection of society at large. And my understanding, my take is that there is some of these issues are not exclusive to the Canadian Armed Forces. They're not exclusive to Canadian society. It's a global issue.
At this point, CBC doesn't have this video, but our colleague, senior defense reporter Murray Brewster, received a description of it from a source at the Defense Department. And separate CBC reporting points to an increase in incidents of hateful conduct. You talked about the global environment, but do you think that there is something within the armed forces that deserves closer scrutiny?
Well, if my statistics, my understanding of the statistics is correct, I mean, we had a far greater number of incidents when the system, the reporting system, started in, I believe, in 2020. And then it went down. I mean, the lowest we've had in 2023. And then it's been creeping back up for 24, and already for 25, the numbers of are as high, if not higher, than the entire year for 2023. But again, there is some general dissatisfaction with governance, if you will. And also, I'm not too sure yet. I haven't seen the video myself, but I am told that there's an element here of a breakdown, if you will, between reserve force members and regular force members. Regular force members are much more, if you will, closely monitored or led by their leaders, because that's their profession. Not the same case with reservists.
So are you saying you're less concerned about it, or it's less of a cause of concern if these are reservists rather than regular force members?
It's a concern, but it's also a concern for society in general, is I guess
so
the point that I'm trying
to... So you'd put less onus on the military?
Well, the military is held to a higher standard. I understand that, but I wouldn't go as far as saying that we have an epidemic. Yes, we need to be concerned, but I believe it can be handled relatively well with the systems that we have in place.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those systems. You referenced the numbers, this system introduced in 2020 to track hateful conduct. The onus is on soldiers to report these incidents. How well is the system working?
Well, yes, the onus is on people that observe to report, but that's only part of the equation. The second, of course, is there are leaders who also see and monitor and work with people that may have these extremist views. And so they need to monitor as well. And the third one that we don't talk about too much is that there's still a requirement for a rigorous screening process when members join the military. And, you know, with all that has been happening in the last several years, including the need to get more people into the forces and opening the doors wider, I think the screening process has been not as rigid.
The thing is, Tony, we are at a time where the government is preparing to make massive investments in the Canadian military. We need more members of the Canadian military. As a country, we are putting a lot into this institution, a lot of faith and a lot of resources. Yes, asking a lot to absolutely in terms of what we're asking folks to do. But what can the military do better? It's not just this incident, that incident that folks will remember earlier this summer, allegations of terrorist activity involving folks with military ties. What does the military need to do better to stamp this out?
Well, certainly the process, the reporting system that we have in place has to continue to be applied rigorously. Education, absolutely. The military is a profession that is here to defend Canadian values and Canada. So the military leadership, and General Wright is correct in saying that this has to be dealt with promptly. But I think in the long term, part of the education and the cultural change is something that needs to be persistent. And we need to stay on the rails, if you will, in that it's going to take some time, and not to lose faith in this great profession.
Well, I guess that's where I want to leave this, is do you worry about the harm that could come to the military when people see... I mean, Nazis, we're talking about the most extreme kind of hate here. What kind of damage is at risk here for the Canadian Armed Forces if they don't address this?
I agree that the damage can be very serious and enormous. I also would like to think that within the military, we're serious about continuing to eradicate that extremism, and that the Canadian society doesn't put every single soldier in the same bin, because the vast majority of those that are in today and those that are knocking at the recruiting centers to join, and Canada needs them, they're great Canadians.
Tony, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks, Catherine. Much appreciated.
Take care.
Tony Batista is a retired Canadian Armed Forces colonel who also served in the military police. He is in Ottawa. Tonight, Defense Minister David McGuinty addressed this story in a statement that reads in part, quote, "Hateful conduct and extremism have no place in the Canadian Armed Forces. The Canadian Army acted swiftly and the matter has been referred to the military police and a disciplinary investigation is underway," unquote. Chocolate. Some will tell you it's divine, incomparable, ineffable, the food of angels delivered from some heavenly realm to our unworthy mortal tongues. Others believe it's fine, they guess. I might know someone in that second group, but people always get mad at them for not loving chocolate, so I'm withholding my identity. I mean, their identity. Okay, it's me. And I wish I liked chocolate more, because chocolate lovers get to achieve swoony transcendence whenever they want simply by eating it. And now, to add insult to injury, new research suggests chocolate could get even more transcendent, because scientists have uncovered new knowledge about where chocolate gets its flavor from. David Gopalchen is a plant geneticist at the University of Nottingham. We reached him in Nottingham, UK.
David, I'm worried. Are you figuring out how to make chocolate even harder to resist?
Yeah, I think so.
oh, no.
we're working on making chocolate taste even better. So I would think that's a good thing.
Tell me why on earth you decided that that was something that ought to be done.
So to make chocolate, we need cocoa beans. Depending on where the beans are produced, you can get different flavors, right? So, for instance, beans produced in Madagascar tend to be very fruity, right? Whereas beans produced in West Africa tend to have a very strong chocolate note. And our question essentially is, what's driving this difference in flavor?
And when you set out to investigate that, was your hope to basically make chocolate more delicious, or most delicious, I guess, based on this research?
Our main driver really was curiosity. What were the factors driving this difference? What was behind this? Our purpose wasn't really to create all these new exciting flavors, but it was just really to try to answer that question.
And so what did you find was the key for us lay people to what makes that difference? Yeah.
We looked at chocolate or cocoa fermentations in Colombia. It's a process. It's one of the processing steps in order to produce chocolate. So to take the beans from the farm all the way to actually producing a chocolate bar, you require this processing step. And what we found was that microbes from the environment is driving this difference. And we were able to pick up differences in these microbes across different locations. And how we did that was looking at farms across Colombia, and we saw differences in the microbes across these farms that was leading to differences in the flavor profiles.
And once you identified the differences, then what did you do?
So having identified these differences, the question was, could we then replicate this in our lab? So that's pretty much what we did, right? So we were able to isolate these microbes from the environment, and then we combined them, and then we added them to our cocoa beans, this raw ingredient. And what we found was quite remarkable.
So tell me what that moment was like. You're in the lab and you actually, do you bite into the chocolate?
First of all, well, we would have carried out this test in the lab, but afterwards, to verify this, we then had a chocolate taster. So these are professional chocolate tasters evaluate our lab fermented beans. And what they found was our fermented beans was able to mimic a lot of the flavor properties of natural fermentations, which for us was amazing.
So as a scientist, I'm sure that that is a very rewarding and exciting moment. As a human being, did you sneak a piece of the chocolate?
How could you resist, right? It's science, but it's a bit of art, because you're creating flavors, right? And now we're at the point where we're able to predict or design flavors. So if, for instance, I want to create the chocolates that are a lot more fruity or and more a bit more nutty, I could combine different microbes to get that flavor profile, which is awesome.
And so how much work is there now between your work in the lab and this being something people could actually buy in a store where these practices, your research is being put into use?
Well, we'll have to see how it is the industry adopts this technology. Before, it was a mystery, right? But what in this study, what we've done is pull back the curtains. We've now gone into the world where we could actually understand this process well enough, where we could manipulate it and create flavors that are in existence in nature, but even create new flavors that don't even exist right now. How does the industry take this forward? I think there's a lot of possibilities, but let's see how that plays out.
Is there anything that you have thought of as you've been imagining how your research might get used? What sort of new flavors we might see in the future?
Personally, I like very fruity type chocolate. So chocolate with a strong cocoa undertone, right? But on top of that, I really like chocolates with a burst of fruitiness at the start, then transitions more into like a floral type somewhere in the middle, and then ends off with a bit of spice. So that's my perfect chocolate taste, my preference. But that can vary from person to person. It's really an experience.
Were you this much of a chocolate connoisseur when this whole process started?
I think I was probably below the average chocolate lover before. But getting into the world of chocolates and really experiencing what chocolate's supposed to taste like just blew my mind. I never knew that you can generate so much amazing flavors with chocolate. It was just such an eye-opening experience. And since then, I've never gone back, right? I'm so passionate about it.
Oh, well, I can tell. It was really nice to meet you, David. Thank you for your time. I got to go. I'm kind of hungry. But thank you for this conversation.
Okay, let's see you.
David Gopalchin is a plant geneticist at the University of Nottingham and the co-author of a new study on chocolate, which was published in the journal Nature Microbiology. We reached him in Nottingham, UK. When I say the words hair toothpaste, you might not like it. I'll be honest, I didn't like saying it, and I'm not going to like saying it again. But scientists at King's College London hope to convince us not to hate hair-based toothpaste because they've discovered it can do wonders for our teeth. It turns out that the keratin in hair doesn't just protect tooth enamel, it can help repair it by producing its own protective coating. So if you have bad teeth, this could become your main solution. Main like hair. I didn't like saying that either. The researchers say products could be available to the public in 2 or 3 years at a price that makes it accessible to most people with teeth who want to put goo on them that's made of hair. I mean, to be fair, it won't be like a sort of a glob of strands of hair like you would pull out of your shower drain. We all know that never works. The toothpaste will be minty and foamy and just as seemingly hairless as regular mouth products. And it doesn't necessarily have to be made from a stranger's hair, if that makes it any better. The researchers suggest it will be possible for people to have keratin extracted from their very own hair, which is good because our own hair is less gross than someone else's hair, marginally. Is it? Actually, I don't know. I still find it gross, but going to try not to brush to judgment. Here's Footprints with Dangers of the Mouth. Footprints with Dangers of the Mouth.
We're going to take a short break now, but when we return, as part of a peace deal, Russia wants a highly fortified area that's been a key part of Ukraine's defense. A Canadian journalist in Ukraine tells us why ceding it isn't likely to fly.
And coffee grinding to a halt. Starbucks in South Korea has a new policy on customers working in the cafe. Bring your laptop, sure, but please leave your desktop computer and printer at home.
Stay tuned. I'm Catherine Cullen.
And I'm Chris Howden.
Thanks for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. 7 o'clock, Sarah is your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. Support comes from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pequegama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. We need you to defend KAXE with your donations. Due to federal funding losses, these are uncertain times for our station, and there are many ways to preserve people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Visit kaxe.org/give. Thank you so much for your support. United Way of 1000 Lakes hosts the Lumberjack Mile and 5K Saturday, September 6. Races begin at 9 a.m. at Grand Rapids Public Utilities. Registration starts at 8. For more information, visit uwlakes.org/lumberjack.
Negotiations over a possible peace deal between Ukraine and Russia have continued to intensify this week. Today, NATO leaders were discussing security guarantees and affirming their support for Kyiv. But the two sides still want dramatically different things. And U.S. President Donald Trump seems willing to entertain Vladimir Putin's demand that Ukraine give up control of the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk in exchange for peace. Some analysts fear that that would only open Ukraine up to another Russian invasion in the future, mainly because Donetsk contains a key line of defense known as the Fortress Belt. Tim Mack is a Canadian journalist and the founder of the website The Counteroffensive. We reached him in Vinnytsia, Ukraine.
Tim, can you describe this Fortress Belt for us?
So we're talking wire, concrete, trenches, gravel, entrenchments, fighting positions. This is basically an area that has been holding back the Russian military's ability to push deeper into Ukraine for not just a few years, but more than a decade. So since the beginning of Russian aggression in 2014.
I mean, you seem to be pointing to it there, but just how crucial then is this to Ukraine's broader defense?
I mean, I think the answer to that question is in the results, which is that it's been able to keep, to hold the line. I mean, Ukraine is a country that is significantly smaller than Russia, both in physical size and in terms of population, has a much smaller economy. And despite that fact, they've been able to use this defensive line to great effect. Russia has a military that's well over a million people strong, and they just haven't been able to break through this line. And so I think that shows you just how critical it's been over more than a decade of keeping Russia from breaking into more central areas in Ukraine.
And how explicit has Vladimir Putin been about looking to gain control of the Fortress Belt?
Well, you know, it's been a very tricky kind of demand because he obviously has not said, hey, we want to go and take over these series of entrenchments. What he said is that he wants and he believes that these regions in the Donbass, the eastern Ukraine, are properly Russian territories. What he doesn't say that is that if the West were to, or if Ukraine were to, acknowledge Russian control over these areas, that he'd be able to then, if he tried to invade again in the future, do so on the other side of these entrenchments. So he doesn't make this explicit demand for these defensive positions, but it's implicit in what he's asking for. A much better strategic position should he ever decide to invade Ukraine again.
And you have been speaking to Ukrainian soldiers who fought in this region. What do they say when they hear about talks of a potential land for peace deal that could include the Fortress Belt?
You know, we've spoken at the counteroffensive. We've spoken to people who helped build this fortress belt, who have tried and fought near and around this fortress belt. I mean, it's a matter of not just national pride, but personal sacrifice. And so it's not a matter of whether or not Ukraine wants the war to end. I think if you ask people in Ukraine, do they hope that the end of the war is imminent? I think you'll get a large majority of people agreeing with that sentiment. But when you ask them, what is it that you'd be willing to give up for that? I think a lot of people, I think the vast majority of people would be skeptical of a deal that gives up territory that Ukraine hasn't lost on the battlefield. And in fact, thousands of Ukrainian soldiers have died fighting to hold that line. It'd be really a very difficult concession to stomach.
If Ukraine was forced to withdraw from these areas, is there anything Ukraine could do to avoid leaving the fortifications of the fortress belt behind?
I think the only kind of last resort type thing that they could do is destroy the fortifications as they leave them. That is, so that they couldn't be used by Russian forces in the future. But I want to just kind of zoom in on something that you said, which is if Ukraine were forced to do this. I think you're going to find that Ukraine has a lot more agency in this process than this this geopolitical perspective where they're kind of chess pieces on a board gives them credit for. I don't think Ukraine is going to accept an outcome where they give up vast swaths of territory and entrenchments and villages and people that they haven't already lost on the battlefield. I think it's going to be very, very hard to stomach. And I suspect that if the government were to agree to such a deal, there'd be widespread protests all across Ukraine against such a negotiation.
And yet it is such a live part of the broader geopolitical discussion. And I take your point that may be very disconnected from the visceral reality the people of Ukraine are living. But I guess I wonder where you think things stand on the possibility of some sort of compromise to find a path to peace.
I think that there are some compromises that are possible, to include maybe even Ukrainian acknowledgement, tacit acknowledgement of the realities on the battlefield, which is that Russia occupies a substantial portion of Ukraine, about 20%. But to give up additional territory, I think it's going to be very hard to stomach. And it's not just a matter of whether Zelensky and the government will agree to these kinds of concessions. It's whether the people will stomach it. I think we've seen that Ukrainian folks are extremely proud of their ability to engage in civic action, to protest and demonstrate. And I think Zelensky realizes that we're overdue for an election, or Ukrainians are overdue for an election here in this country, and that one will probably be held shortly after the cessation of hostilities. He's going to need, if he wants to run again, to come to some sort of negotiated end that's palatable to a lot of Ukrainians if he seeks another term in office.
Tim, I appreciate your insights and your perspective today. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Tim Mack is a Canadian journalist and the founder of The Counteroffensive. We reached him in Vinnytsia, Ukraine. On yesterday's program, we heard about people in Newfoundland who are desperately waiting to hear if their homes have made it through the fires. So far, the provincial government has confirmed that more than 200 structures have been destroyed by the massive Kingston wildfire. And now one more couple has received a call, and it was not good news. The fire consumed the home of Steve and Elsa Fitzgerald. And worse yet, they had no insurance on the property.
We got a call about 8 o'clock, I guess, last night, that our home had been ravaged by the fire. It was my husband's family home when he lost everything. All the memories, all the pictures, whatever, you know, that was in the house that we didn't think or didn't have time to take.
Was it you took the phone call last night?
My husband did, but then he was so heartbroken he couldn't talk. He couldn't speak, so he asked me to listen to the lady and talk to her. So that's what I did, yeah. And then she told us, she hated to tell us, but our home had been lost in the fire. And, I mean, she was really kind about it, and there was all kinds of supports that we could get, but there's nothing going to replace your home. And we didn't have insurance, so our home's gone, and we don't even know if we can rebuild. And it's just me and my husband, so I guess we'll figure it out.
I mean, you're in a wheelchair. Yeah. You lost one of your legs, and your prosthetic leg was left in the home?
Yes. My leg is starting to cause trouble, so I had my leg off, the artificial leg off. And when we left in the middle of the night, 11:30 in the night, we got the call. I never even thought to grab my leg. I said, well, that'll give it a couple of days rest and it'll be healed up when I go home. But now my leg is gone. That's it. It's all gone.
What's next? What do you do now? I mean, I know it's just so fresh, but
I actually don't know. So it's only my husband working, and he's off right now due to medical reasons. So he goes back to work for September. He's going to have to stay somewhere else, and I'll stay with my daughter, I guess, for now, until we can figure out what to do.
There was somebody with government, say, who was listening to our conversation. What would be your message to them about the support that people need in your community?
I hope the government would step up and help people like me who can. Don't have an option right now. My option is put a tent on my land if I ever get back. I can't afford to build a house with one person working. So, I mean, I hope they step up and are able to help the people that don't have insurance, at least somehow.
That was Elsa Fitzgerald talking to Patrick Butler of Radio Canada. Her home was lost in a wildfire in Newfoundland and Labrador. Researchers reckon they're learning more about one of Canada's most famous cowboys. Recently on a dig in Millerville, Alberta, a team of archaeologists unearthed artifacts belonging to John Ware, a black cowboy who embarked on a ranching career in the 19th century, despite the rough terrain and despite having been born into slavery. While the tales of his legendary cattle herding are well known, what actual day-to-day life was like for him and his wife Mildred was more obscure until now. Lindsay Amundson-Meyer is the lead archaeologist on the project and an assistant professor at the University of Calgary. She told the CBC what she and her team found at the dig site.
I mean, it's been pretty amazing, if I'm being honest. You know, a year ago, we weren't sure if there would even be anything there or if it would have all been impacted by road construction that's happened in the last, you know, 50 years or so. So to go from that uncertainty to this year finding quite literally intact wooden structural remains of the Ware home, that was pretty incredible. Really well preserved in what we now know for sure is the cellar of his house. We have floorboards, wooden floorboards held onto log beams with square nails, and we know those predate 1900. So that was definitely pretty incredible to unearth. And then associated with that, we've got a very nice discrete layer of well-dated artifacts. So things like the suspender clip, an ink bottle that we know was manufactured between 1895 and 1930, and some other dated items as well that really show us that all of these things are in fact associated with the time period when the Wares were living there. So I think one of the things that's fascinating about the Wares is that a lot of us know the name John Ware, but the reality is we don't actually know a lot about him, or certainly his family or their daily life. And in large part, that's because the historic records we do have about the Wares are not contemporaneous with their actual life, right? A lot of them are coming from the 1930s when his fellow cowboys are remembering him or different stories. And that's several decades after his death. So the contemporaneous historic records are there in you know, some homestead documents and things like that, but they're pretty rare. And so archaeology in that sense gives us this really unique opportunity to quite literally try to look at his life from the ground up by looking at the types of belongings that he was using or they were using, right, and that they had access to or preferred. And I think there's sort of two things that are fascinating to me. One is we think we're seeing a level of affluence in the artifacts that we're finding, which I don't think we've typically associated with the Ware story. And then the other piece is that we always talk about John Ware, but, you know, he did have a wife, Mildred, and her name and her story hasn't lived on in the same way.
Yeah.
And we've certainly got items that we recovered this year that are women's items, are items used for caring for children. And so those are most likely associated with Mildred more so than John, right? And so we're really hoping that we may be able to tell her story better as well.
Lindsay Amundson-Meyer speaking with the CBC's Chris De La Torre, host of The Homestretch. Too much working, and it is just not working. In Starbucks locations in South Korea, like everywhere else, there's Wi-Fi and there are outlets, which makes them great places to set yourself up for a few hours of work, typing on your laptop, fueled by a venti half-sweet green tea frappuccino with four pumps of vanilla and a shot of espresso. But apparently in South Korea, customers' occupations are becoming a preoccupation. They're still buying the frappuccinos, but they're also setting up entire makeshift cubicles for themselves in Starbucks, bringing in desktop computers and printers and what the company refers to as other bulky items. So earlier this month, Starbucks refined its policy. You're welcome to bring your laptop and iPad in, but please leave your photocopiers and fax machines at the office. They are not relaxing. That story reminded us of another cafe with a policy on politeness. In this case, a sliding scale of pricing for its signature cup of chai. From 2022, here's Neil's conversation with Usman Hussain, the owner of the chai shop in Preston, England.
Usman, walk me through these desi chai prices you've posted up in your shop. Three price points for the exact same cup of chai. How does one get tea at the cheapest price?
So the answer to that is they have to come in and just be friendly and polite when they order. They'll get the cheapest option, which is the £1.90.
Which is just about $3 Canadian. We were doing the math before our chat here. They say please, but they don't say hello, for example.
Oh, that's going to cost them something they'll remember.
How much does the price go up then?
That's up to £3. So that's an additional £1.10.
An additional £1.10 for not saying hello. All right. And then the most expensive, though, comes in, and this is pretty high, £5. That's $7 Canadian and 80 cents.
$7.
Is £5 a normal price for tea or coffee?
No, definitely not.
Well, so what does somebody have to do to be punished in that way?
They have to come in, not make eye contact, head down, and just say desi chai.
Yeah. And
yeah.
How do they react, that person you've described, when you say £5, please?
So instead of saying £5, please, we say, would you like to choose again? And point at the board. And this is the first time they've lifted their head up that morning. And they take a look. And funnily enough, they then begin to come out of the shell. And the best line we have is customers coming in and saying, can I order one hello desi chai, please?
They think that's the name. They think that's the name of the item.
Or can I get two hello desi chais, please?
And what do you say to that?
We just have a laugh about it. And since putting this sign up, it's literally like every single customer, you just have a connection with, and you just give them that bit more of a customer service.
Yeah, and that connection you mentioned that is now exploding because of the sign and the interactions. How does that affect your day?
It makes it worthwhile that much more, dealing with people who are happy, who are coming in having a laugh with you, who are actually speaking and interacting with us. And it feels better for us, to be honest, for when we think back at the day and think how did we treat the customers, and all we can remember is all our customers laughing and joking as they're leaving the shop. It really boosts our morale too.
Why do you think it has to be said in the first place? What do you think, you know, what does it signal to you that people have to be reminded to be kind?
This is what I've been thinking about ever since, to be honest, and I don't think I've got the answer for it. A few things I've come up with is, you know, sometimes we're busy in day-to-day life, things are moving fast. You know, another reason, we may be going through a hard time, we're forgetting who's around us or who we're interacting with. On top of that, we've got, I mean, I myself am addicted to caffeine. Once I wake up in the morning, I need a coffee fix or a tea fix. And some people don't operate until they get that.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Sometimes people have to come with warning labels as well, pre-caffeine. I have heard variations on this idea in the past in the United States, Virginia. There was a cafe a few years ago. What was the moment you decided to do this?
This was the exact inspiration. It was actually the gentleman who decided that in Virginia. I actually took a screenshot off that board 2 years ago, and I was just going through my camera roll, and I stumbled across it again. And then I went back and actually did some research as to where that's come from. So he actually got inspired from somebody from France.
Love it. Cross-cultural pollination of this idea of kindness. It has traveled the world to get to you and now beyond as your story explodes, coverage here in Canada as well. Why do you think this resonates so much?
I think the main reason is because it should be the foundation. It should be a principle everyone follows. We all, as human beings, agree that should be the standard, that should be the norm, but yet we're not actually doing that.
Well, before we let you go, Usman, what makes your desi chai so delicious?
It's brewed to its finest, as we say.
Thanks so much for this.
You're more than welcome.
From 2022, Neil's conversation with Usman Hussain, the owner of the chai shop in Preston, England. Sarah Ezekiel of the UK was in her early 30s and pregnant with her second child when she was diagnosed with motor neuron disease. And it wasn't long before that disease stole much of the use of her body, including her voice. In the 2.5 decades since, Ms. Ezekiel has used a mechanical voice to communicate. But now, thanks to a startup AI company, she's got her own voice back, or at least a close approximation. It was created using just 8 seconds of her real voice from an old home video. She told the BBC's Emma Tracy what it's like to have that voice back.
I'm Sarah Ezekiel and was diagnosed with MND when I was 34 and pregnant with my second child, Eric, in April 2000.
That's your old synthetic voice. Give me a blast of your new voice.
Hello, this is my voice. It's a kind of miracle, really.
Wow, that just sounds really different. The first one sounded a bit Joanna Lumley. This one sounds incredibly different. How did it feel?
After such a long time, I couldn't really remember my voice before MND. When I first heard it again, I felt like crying and it was very emotional. My kids couldn't remember my voice and I think they were thrilled to hear the real me. Maybe a bit surprised too. I feel like myself again and I don't sound like a robot.
Sarah Ezekiel talking to the BBC's Emma Tracy in her new voice, which is her old voice. That was our sound of the day.
Been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Houghton. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Catherine Cullen. Take care.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. I am Sarah Serra, your host, and this is On the River. It looks as though tonight there are going to be increasing clouds, low in the upper 50s, lower 60s. Thursday, chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and at night, partly sunny. Highs near 80, a south wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Friday looks as though sunny, high near 70, a west wind 5 to 10.